Thank you so much for everyone for being here. I know there is some really great stuff happening right now, so I really appreciate you being here. Hopefully we can make it awesome. I am going to be giving a standard presentation, introducing, this is my first slide. And so I will be talking about basically introducing the soil micro livestock. That's what I'm calling them, the soil microbiology, basically. But to understand the functional groups and what they can do for the garden, for the field. I'll be talking about my background a little bit first, the need for the right kind of micro livestock, the functional groups, how obviously there's so much in the soil in terms of species, but how do we understand them in a way that will help us manage them correctly? And then talk about the ecological relationships and really what drives their benefit to us, and the impacts on plant growth, obviously, is what we want to see. And then I will be transitioning to the microscope in a little bit. So first, I am not a farmer, but I have been interested in environment and agriculture for a while. I've got a couple degrees in environmental engineering, a degree in natural resources forestry. I was a farmhand for a season on a 10-acre veggie farm, organic veggie farm in Florida. I recently was a soil conservation technician with the NRCS in Wisconsin. Okay. And so I'm a lab certified technician with the Soil Food Web. And so I don't know if has anyone heard of the Soil Food Web? Fantastic. Okay, great. And so I'm the owner also of Black Box Soil Lab.
You're all set.
Fantastic. Okay, Soil Food Web is the framework that I'm going to be talking about today. And it was developed by Dr. Elaine Ingham out of Oregon State University and the Rodale Institute. And I am not an employee of the Soil Food Web, just to be clear about that. Not getting paid at all. But I am currently in the consultant training program. So that's after the lab technician portion. Okay, so this is going to be really quick, hopefully. For the people in the organic milieu who already understand the issues of conventional farming, I just want to try and make the case that it's because we don't have partly because we don't have the right microbes in the soil is that we're seeing some of these problems. So as far as nutrient cycling goes, we don't have the right microbes in the soil, so we need to apply, some folks need to apply the synthetic fertilizers, and that shuts down the relationship between the plant root and the microbiology, so there's less in the soil, and so you see this vicious cycle or a downward spiral, depending on what kind of diagrams you can get on PowerPoint. So the problems look like 45 billion pounds of fertilizer applied in the U.S. and so many rivers and streams impacted with the pollution. So for plant disease, we don't have the right microbes in the soil protecting the plant roots, the plant leaves, and so you don't have that protection that nature usually affords. So some people apply the synthetic pesticides and fungicides, and you have the pathogens anyway, and the soil ecosystem can't repair itself. So our outcomes are that we have plenty of pesticides going into the land, applied to the land, and then you have the sixth mass extinction happening with insects being the canary in the coal mine, and you have the impaired waters, as we just saw. Finally, soil erosion and compaction. Again, you don't have the right microbes in the soil, and also you're the heavy equipment is not helping with the compaction. But the soil aggregates are not being created because you don't have the right microbes in the soil. There's nothing really for them to hold on to during rains, during winds. And so that soil, that topsoil is lost, and you have, you know, less, the soil ecosystem can't repair itself, so you have less of the right microbes next year. And then, you know, I was thinking, looking at this beautiful river this morning, that climate change, of course, is another big issue that does relate to the right soil microbes. Sorry. So the outcomes of the soil compaction and soil erosion. In the Midwest, we have lowered ag fields at a rate of 2 millimeters per year over the past 150 years. And so, you can see that person standing about a meter above, I think it was a cemetery that he's standing next to an ag field. Okay, so now that we know about the importance of the right microbes, I want to introduce you to them. We're gonna be talking about functional groups and just to understand. So these are the microbes that you may or may not have on your land, right? And I'm talking about functional groups here. This is the methodology of the soil food web. So we have the good guys and the bad guys. Sorry about the gendered language, but this is what's used. It usually follows this dichotomy, this binary, between oxygen levels. If it's a good guy microbe, it'll be aerobic with air. If it's a bad guy microbe, it'll be without air, or anaerobic. Usually, we have these groups: filamentous, the long stuff, fungi usually, the protozoa, which we'll get to, the bacteria, and the nematodes. So we have good guys and bad guys in each of these functional groups. Okay, so aerobic filamentous microorganisms. We have uniform widths of the strands. Okay, this is a very nice looking. Look at how nice this actually looks. You have a little coloration there. We can actually measure the width of the thing. So the longer, the more width, the better. And then you see these septa here that are separating. That are separating the walls. Star. These are the septa right here at uniform lengths along the length. And so that's a really good aerobic fungi, and Basidiomycota and Ascomycota are the, I think, families of these. And then in contrast, we have the anaerobic fungi, which can be in your soil, and it shows that your soil has very low oxygen levels. If you have a lot of this stuff, which is oomycetes, you have problems with your soil in terms of oxygen conditions. So we have non-uniform widths. It's clear usually. It has bubbles in it, and it's just generally ugly. Compared to this nice thing, and then you have it's like clumpy or in wefts usually, and wilt or mildew or blight are examples of this. So actinobacteria are they're in the bacteria family, and you can't see, I can see this, I can see that from here, but you probably can't see it. We might be able to see it in the samples that we're going to do, but this is another indicator of low oxygen environment. Even though it is filamentous, it's not a fungi. But it is hair-like and, yeah, low oxygen. Protozoa. These are the good guys, aerobic protozoa. We have flagellates. These are about 5 microns long, and I don't know if you can see this very thin hair. This is the flagellate. This actually has 2 flagellates right here. This has 1 flagellate, and they have like a bumbling motion. And so we can identify them by the way that they kind of have no idea where they're going. And then we can see usually that little wispy flagella there. But they're good. They are eating the bacteria. Amoeba or amoebae. So there's plenty of different forms of amoebae. We have the Arcella amoebae right here. The pseudopodium right here, and then the amoebae, which are in a test. And so these are testate amoebae in a nice case, I suppose. But they're also good. They're also eating the bacteria in a good way, and we'll talk about that in a second. So ciliates are the anaerobic protozoa. So we don't really want to see so many of these. These are indicative of low oxygen environments as well. They are eating bacteria, but you know we wanna get air into the soil if we see too many of these. What we have there's plenty of different types of them. This is a stalked. This is like attached to something right here, and so this is just staying right here. And this these hairs are sort of filtering in the bacteria. This microorganism is just kind of moving around a lot, and you see cilia all around the organism, and that's the giveaway there. A little bigger than the flagellates, rather. Okay, the nematodes. These are pretty awesome, and you know, there's like professors of nematology and all that stuff because it's pretty darn interesting. So I don't see any, you know, I don't see awesome pictures like these, but these are all like electron microscope, and I didn't bring an electron microscope. I brought light microscope, but these are awesome pictures, right? So these are teeth right here, and they belong to a predator, or I think predator. And so I think this is bacteria eating nematode, and this one is the plant eating nematode, the bad guy, right? So how do we tell them apart with a light microscope? We have the mouth. We look at the mouth. We can do that. So we have bacterial feeder not only does it have some kind of ornate mouth usually at the top, it also has these two bulbs. There's a better word for those. The fungal feeder has this spear at the top here. And this is what it uses to spear the fungal cell, right? This root feeder is the bad guy, and this has a spear as well, but this also has a piston in back of it because I guess the root is harder than the fungi to get through. So if we see the piston, we know it's a root feeder. This is the predatory nematode, and this actually eats other nematodes, right? So we can tell that one by the tooth that we have, and we saw that better picture before. And then this omnivore, I guess it usually eats fungi. I haven't seen one of these, but it has sort of a blade in the top here, and it can eat fungi or bacteria. Okay, I guess I'm going through this just because it's cool, A, and then B, we're also going to be looking through the microscope in a little bit. So just remember these because no quizzes. We see the piston right here on the spear, and that's the root feeder. The predatory nematode, I got an action shot here. So it's taking care of that nematode with the tooth. Another electron microscope. So there's so many species of bacteria of nematodes, but this is a bacterial feeding nematode, and then the fungal feeder with the spear without the piston. at the top here. I'll talk about that in a second. Okay, and then this awesome picture, right? So nature is awesome and just. I don't know about that. But this is a nematode-eating fungus. So we just, you know, this is the fungus-eating nematode, right? But then nature said, we're gonna give the fungi a chance to attack. And so this fungi has these loops on it. And then once a nematode sticks its head through, the fungus swells up these things and strangles the nematode and then dissolves it from the outside in. So I thought that was pretty awesome.
It's the cowboy of the world.
Yeah. So we have functional groups with the bacteria as well. We have the aerobic, we have the anaerobic, we also have the pathogenic. And so we don't want to see, obviously, the anaerobic, we don't want to see the pathogenic bacteria that, you know, could be harmful for us potentially. But we also don't want to see the aerobic. What do we have? We have, so these are some pathogenic, a corkscrew or a spirochete. This is Spirilla right here. The Vibrio, we don't want to see that one. That's a pathogenic. But we also see their coccus, diplococci, streptococci in a line, the staphylococci in a base, bowling pin, formation. We have cocobacillus, bacillus, diplobacilli. So these are, these are the aerobic. I'm going to come back to the anaerobic in a minute. So just to finish out here, so what we just saw were the major functional groups that we're looking at, right? The bacteria, nematodes, fungi, and protozoa. So the arthropods or the microarthropods are the next level in the food chain. I'll just show that here. So this is the kind of a famous soil food web system, and we can see this hierarchy here. And there's this arthropods, which are the shredders. You can see them more closely up here. But these are all the mites that are in our soil, and they are, you know, maybe feeding on bacteria as well, but they could be feeding on the nematodes. They like to shred up the organic matter, and these guys are pretty cool. Springtails, so they actually, like, are a taxi cab for the bacteria and the microorganisms. So, like, they spring up onto the plant, and now you've just transferred, or the microorganisms have been transferred to your leaves and upper part of the plant. So that's helpful, right? You want, in a really good system, you want the beneficial aerobic bacteria, soil microorganisms all over the top of your plant as well as the roots. And then we see, so the nematodes are up here, and they're eating everything. Roots is fungi and bacteria. The shredders are up here, and then we get to the mammals and birds that we know. Okay, so what is driving this is the plant root exudates. I have seen 20 to 30% of the sugars made by the plant are sent into the ground, into the soil, through the roots. I mean, I've even seen, you know, numbers higher than that in terms of what's been in the literature. Plants do this because they have that relationship with the soil food web. And I want to explain it just a little bit. The bacteria and the fungi are attracted to these root exudates, right? So they colonize the root, and they are eating those exudates. And why would the plant give it a free lunch, right? Well, that's a question. But I just want to say that the other things bacteria and fungi are doing, they're extracting minerals from rock. They are producing these extracellular polymeric substances, which are gluing themselves to particles and gluing particles to each other. So that's where the creation of the soil aggregates are coming from, the microaggregates and the macroaggregates. The fungi are producing this glomalin. So they are also providing the food. They are the food for these higher things, right? So very interesting here. So bacteria and the hyphae, the head of a fungi, have a carbon to nitrogen ratio of 5:1, okay? It's very high nitrogen, right? Our composts, our bodies ourselves, and the bodies of the nematodes and the protozoa are more like 30:1 carbon to nitrogen. So they're snacking on all these bacteria and fungi, and they're doing thousands. They're eating thousands, tens of thousands every day, okay? So what do they do with all this excess nitrogen? They're excreting it, right? And where are they excreting it? Well, they're excreting it near the plant root, which is where the bacteria and fungi are. And it just so happens to be in a form, the nitrogen, that the plant can take it up real quick, okay? So that is the nitrogen cycling of a really healthy soil food web, is because they're pooping. These protozoa and nematodes, rather. Okay, so we talked about soil formation. To me, the soil food web is really the basis of soil health. We have fungi that are long enough. So I mentioned the head of the fungi has like a 5:1 carbon to nitrogen ratio. The body, the mycelia, the rest of the fungi has a carbon to nitrogen ratio of like 1,000:1. So this is the stuff that's not eaten, and it stays recalcitrant because of the formation of the fungi. So we're talking about carbon sequestration. We're talking about humic acid buildup. So you want humates in the soil, right? These are the good recalcitrant sources for nutrients and carbon storage. So that's what the soil food web is doing, is producing the humates and the fulvic acids. We have that soil aggregation, so we have more water infiltration. And how are we doing on time?
1:25.
Awesome. We have weed suppression. Oh, well, we'll talk about that in a second. We have disease suppression as well. Disease suppression is when all of the microbes are on the roots and on the plants, and it prevents the pathogenic microorganisms from getting there via just the physical blocking. Sometimes they predate on the pathogenic bacteria, and sometimes they have chemical interactions that inhibit the pathogenic, the function of the pathogenic bacteria. So three actually separate ways, distinct ways that the soil food web can prevent disease. And then this weed suppression that I'll come back to in a second. Plants are receiving the nitrogen from the micro livestock excreta. They are, they're getting the micronutrients from bacterial and fungal mining of rock. And obviously we know that the arbuscular mycorrhizae are getting phosphorus to the plant for exchange for sugars. I just mentioned the prophylactic effect of the soil food web, and so roots are obviously going to be able to explore more if there are spaces created by the formation of soil microaggregates and macroaggregates. Okay, so here's an interesting piece of the soil food web. This is Dr. Elaine Ingham found this out. So there's this fungal to bacterial ratio by biomass, right? So every soil is going to have some proportion of bacteria. You find that concentration. You find the concentration of the fungi by biomass, and then you take a ratio. What Dr. Ingham found was that this ratio correlates to the level of succession of the land, okay? And if we take from our ecological classes that we took, succession is this idea where you start with bare ground, or you very disturbed ground, and then you wait, and then nature comes with maybe mosses and lichen, and then maybe some annuals and weeds come in, grasses and perennials rather as well, and then it matures, right? And then they make way for the small trees and shrubs and the perennials, and then if we have the right climate, we can make it all the way to oak and hickory forest. That's deciduous, and then of course there's the coniferous trees up in the Pacific Northwest. But that is the sort of the way that nature takes or moves if undisturbed. So getting back to this fungal to bacterial ratio, they found that if we have like bare material, it's going to be colonized by bacteria first, right? It's going to be, the soil is going to be nothing but bacteria. If we have, and then we move to, like, they make way for these, the protozoa, the fungi, the nematodes, they are going to be colonizing the soil next. And this is probably still bare ground above ground, but you see that there's something happening here, and the fungal to bacterial ratio is 0.01. We get to a fungal to bacterial ratio of 0.1, and then we see these weeds coming in, okay? High nitrate, so the nitrogen is available as nitrate, and it's still very poor for any kind of plants that you want to have, but this is the next stage of succession. Then we go, these make way for these, the grasses, the brassicas, the mustards, that has a fungal to bacterial ratio of 0.3. And then keep going, and then we have these midgrasses and vegetables. When I say that has a fungal to bacterial ratio of 0.75, I don't mean it has to, but I'm saying that a fungal to bacterial ratio of 0.75 is going to be the real sweet spot for vegetables and grasses, right? This is going to, it's most conducive to growing. This is the fungal to bacterial ratio that is most conducive for growing these, right? We keep going. We got row crops, 0.75 to 1, a fungal to bacterial ratio of 1. Shrubs and vines, 2, the fungi you can see are starting to take over here. So we have 2 to 1 to 5 to 1 is that sweet spot for shrubs and vines. Deciduous trees, you're in the orchards now, and you have a 5 to 1 to 100 to 1 fungal to bacterial ratio. And then coniferous old growth, you know, who doesn't see the fungi growing in the old growth forest, right? So that's 100 to 1 to 1,000 to 1. So the relevance for the growers is, where are you on this successional stage? And, you know, how to get the fungi to be growing in the right proportion to the bacteria, right? I think that's one of the take-home messages here. And then just going back for a second, this has to do for the nerds. This has to do with the fact that the nitrogen is available as it goes from the majority being nitrate to ammonia. Okay, and we see the soil pH decreases, as the fungal to bacterial ratio increases. Okay, so that was a good part. And these are the soil health principles of that NRCS is putting out, right? And you know, hopefully everyone is doing some of these, or at least heard about them, right? These are the soil cover, right? These are the minimizing the disturbance with the no-till, maximizing biodiversity, if you can, maximizing living roots in the soil with your cover crops, and integrating livestock, right? So those are all really good things. And I'm putting them there because the soil food web says this is a great way to build homes for the soil microbiology, right? But if we don't realize that we're building homes for the workers, then we could think that all we need to do are these four things on top here, and that's it, right? But you need the workers, right? And so integrating livestock is one way to bring in the workers. Another way to bring in the workers is to, that's Dr. Elaine Ingham, that's not a worker. She is making the biocomplete livestock, biocomplete compost here that has the correct numbers of protozoa, bacteria, fungi for the things that they want to be growing, right? So we'll look at the numbers in a second. But this is a one way to invite the micro livestock into your fields, right? Is by building that compost, looking at it. We're going to look at it, right? And analyze for the correct concentration of these functional groups. And compost teas, you can make compost teas from the soil, from the solid compost, the finished compost, and teas and extracts. And then it's applying those to the land, right? In various ways, whether mechanical or via hose. These are the numbers that we have for the biocomplete soil. And this is TM right here because this is the soil food web numbers. So 135 micrograms per gram for bacterial and fungal. The ratio greater than 0.3 to 1, right? Because we want to be higher. We don't want to have, you know, if we're growing vegetables or grasses, perennial grasses or row crops, we want to be higher in the 1 to 1, down to that 0.75 to 1, I believe. Protozoa, we want to see 10,000 per gram. And beneficial nematodes, we want to have 100 per gram. Ciliates, minimizing the anaerobic protozoa. We want to see less than five per drop. Okay, take-home messages. Microbes are doing the work of creating the healthy soil. Hopefully I've made some kind of case about that today. And we can take account of the micro livestock and, you know, put them to work for you. This is important. Soil health practices are great, but if there's no soil micro livestock there, you're kind of waiting for them to come into your lands, and it could be a long time, you know. But it's the possibility of introducing them into the land is you should be seeing some quicker results. And then, not all soils are created equally. Not all composts are created equally. We think about this soil, the numbers for the soil biocomplete compost, and we're gonna see hopefully that there's different numbers for each compost, for each soil. So it's important when you're thinking about purchasing and whatnot, purchasing compost, that is. How can you utilize a soil food web? We can understand what kind of functional groups are in our soil. which kind of functional groups are lacking in our soil. And then we can build those numbers through compost production. If you want to find a lab tech, or if you want to find a compost consultant, there are, on the Soil Food Web School website, there are plenty of people doing this kind of work. Me being one of being the lab tech, but this is the that QR code will get you to the map for all the for the consultants who will actually be helping produce the compost. You yourselves, right? Has anyone taken the Soil Food Web Foundational course? Fantastic. Fantastic. That's great. And so, yeah, you could also buy a microscope, right? And what I'd love to see is, like, farmers and gardeners working with their neighbors. And, like, who doesn't want to see what's growing in their soil, right? Super interesting. And, yeah, so microscope meetups are something that they are doing in Manitoba, I know for a fact. And so it could happen here. So that is the presentation part, and I will be making some samples here. We're going to be looking at live samples of worm compost, cow compost, the poop, not the carcass, and mushroom compost. So as I transition here, does anyone have any questions that they'd like to ask? We have a microphone going around.
Microphone so that we can do recording because this event is being recorded. You have a question?
All right. So when you were talking about the anaerobic filamentous, and I'm going to say this so wrong, but I had the two O's, the oomycetes. You said that those were blight causing. Is there anything that you could specifically do if you notice any kind of like unfortunate situations happening in your garden crops to get those kind of fixed or out of there before there's irrevocable harm? Yes.
I'm definitely not an agronomist of any kind, right? But the Soil Food Web would say getting the right biology in there and maybe into the niche of, you know, what that oomycetes are the niche of the oomycetes could block that out. You also, like, air introducing, whatever practices you have for introducing oxygen, that would be another thing I think that would be a recommendation through the Soil Food Web. But yeah, again, not an agronomist.
And that's a big part of your crop rotation. That's why we say rotate your crops to different families, because a lot of these guys are host specific, meaning they like certain plants and they don't like certain plants. So if you don't give them the food they want, they die. Did you ever?
Oh, here you go. Perhaps this is exactly what you're going to show us, but I'm wondering if different types of compost, like compost that's based within chicken waste or cow manure or food waste, do these different types of compost provide different types of good microbes?
Good question.
Yes, in fact they do. So, you know, you have different gut systems of all the ruminants and non-ruminants, and every soil microbiome is going to be different. Absolutely.
And then, of course, it depends on what the animal has eaten and how it's been, the manure has been managed. So there's so many wonders about, you know, every compost is not created equal. Other questions? Here we go.
Hi, I'm a little curious about, I grow blueberries that love acidic soil and yet they're shrubs. So would they prefer fungally dominated or not because they like acidic soil? It's kind of like, are they different than other shrubs, or is it the same thing, just they tolerate, or can you have high fungal content and acidic soil, sandy acidic soil at the same time.
So I do soil microbiome research, and I would push back on the idea that when soil isn't functioning in certain ways, that it doesn't have the things that you're looking for. When we sequence microbiomes out of the soil, we find that the harder you look, the more you find, and many things are in the soil, and even when the soil isn't functioning well, they're still there. The inoculum, the actual, like, you know, that the microbes are there, and their communities will grow when the conditions are right and the preferred food sources are available. And so, my understanding would be very much that in most cases, getting the microbes that have certain functions is about giving them the conditions that they need, because they're not absent. They just need, they need what they need to flourish.
And they're changing all the time, aren't they?
Yeah, and they do change. Yes.
That's the dynamics of it. You over here, yeah. Excuse me. I won't get you. I promise. Sorry.
I was wondering if you could plug into an excess of nitrogen and its effect on the food web, the microbiome.
You were saying something about compost from dead animals versus the poop. What's the difference, and is there, you know, is one better than the other?
I'm sorry, compost from what?
Carcasses of animals, dead animals. Because I see.
And if you want to know the baseline of your compost, if you can obtain it, make it consistently, obtain it from one source and have it tested. And a lot of these days, the compost facilities test them and provide you the test results, as is good for your certification, then you at least have that knowledge of what the average, if you will, because every batch will be a little bit different, but you'll get an understanding of the average, and that's important. To give your soil credits for its nitrogen, as well as to know what you can hope for in terms of soil growth, soil health.
So this guy right here is a flagellate. This is my worm compost, my worm castings, and There's just a ton of testate amoebae right here. You'll find this all over, but this guy is a small guy. I know it's a flagellate. Like you can't see the small flagella, but it's probably like a single or a double. But that is one instance. So yeah, just a lot of testate amoebae around here. These are the humates that are forming. I'm not sure about humates or fulvic acids, but these are the good, sort of recalcitrant end components of compost. So, you know, there's a process that we take when analyzing soil or compost. I am just sort of doing a, you know, let's look see around here. So there's not too much method to this process right here. If we go out, I might be able to see some nematodes, and those are charismatic. I can't hear you. Yeah.
Do you, can you take any more questions?
Yeah, sure.
I'm wondering about the the duality that you presented, kind of a binary between good and bad, and anaerobic and aerobic. I know that, or at least I'm aware that oxygen levels fluctuate in soils, and that it's there are many bacteria which are facultative anaerobes, which function well in anaerobic and aerobic conditions,
right,
and that those are necessary. I'm wondering why you've left that out of the discussion so far. And then another one is I'm wondering why the biocomplete is trademarked. Is that proprietary information, and what information is being withheld behind a paywall?
Okay. So facultative versus obligate air microorganisms in terms of oxygen. Yeah, there's a gray area between the aerobic and the strictly aerobic and strictly anaerobic. Brassicas are in a space where they like a lot of actinobacteria, and the actinobacteria are facultative, so they'll exist in oxygen-rich, but they also can exist in oxygen-poor environments, and brassicas in particular like a lot of actinobacteria, so that's sort of the grayish area. Why I did it for the presentation, I don't know. Maybe I should include it for next time. The trademark. I don't know. I can't speak to that. You have the numbers. I don't know.
Is that,
I mean, it's
part
research.
Part of Elaine Ingham's business?
I'm sorry.
Is that part of Elaine Ingham's business?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. That was developed by Elaine Ingham, Dr. Ingham. Yeah.
Question. I know we can take a microscope to the field, but for practicality, is it better to utilize a lab? And then if so, what are we asking them to measure?
Well, I mean, I don't think I'm asking anyone to bring a microscope into the field. If you have a table, you know, in your house, you can just bring the soil into the house. The process of sending it to let's say my lab is simply putting a soil in a baggie, filling it halfway up with soil, and then mailing that out. I also take compost tea samples as well. I can analyze those, so that's like putting it in a test tube or something and then shipping it to my lab in Oshkosh. But it's pretty simple in that regard. Did I answer your question? Anyway, I think that's all I really can show you. I usually see some nematodes in the vermicompost, but I'm not seeing it right now, so maybe we'll just go to the next one. Any other questions?
Yeah, hi, Michael. Thank you so much for the presentation. We have a new farm, and we have to do something terribly destructive to the soil this spring, some grading for water movement and a foundation, and we're going to be kind of working in 8 acres. We want to be as careful with the soil as we can be and bring it back to the ratios that you've highlighted here in the presentation. What would you encourage us to do among the list of standards, and then approximately with, you know, a human hand that wants to be positive, how long do you think it would take for us to reach that, say, 0.75 to 1 ratio? It's a vegetable farm.
There you go. You've got it, I'm too. Tell him that.
So we have, where'd it go? The question is, was it up or down? To the left? So the cool thing with these guys is that they can sit still if you put a little heat under them.
Are there other questions?
For taking samples to send into your lab, what's your sampling protocol? Are you doing a certain depth? Are you doing plant rhizomes?
So I have a sheet that explains how to take samples, and you want to take samples like 2 inches down and halfway between the drip line of the plant and the stem of the plant. And you want to take like three of those samples, and you want to mix them together. So
I just have a question about the fungi bacteria ratio. There's kind of one school of thought encourages really deep wood chip mulches that create a significant amount of fungi, but that doesn't seem to be what you're advocating for vegetable production. And I've always wondered about that. It seems very two opposing positions. Mm. Can you speak to that high fungus wood chip mulch layer on the top in a vegetable production specific context?
Mm. We're all shaking your heads. I can't really. All I can say is that the soil food web, that state of succession, I can't really comment on why that would be as good. How that would work if the soil food web suggests a lower fungal to bacterial ratio. I really can't. I'm sorry about that.
I was just going to say, add to that, that it's just, I think it seems to me like it's just too much fungi for vegetables. Well. Like, you want to have more bacteria, so by putting that much wood chips, you're fostering more fungal growth, and it's just not appropriate for that type of plant.
Also remember that wood chips carbon ratio, carbon to nitrogen ratio, is very high, and it really could tie up your nutrients. And I would never put wood chips, maybe a mulch, a straw mulch, or hay mulch, but not wood chips. That just ties things up too long, too much for your soil, typically. You know, I guess maybe if you have a muck soil, which is really, really high nitrogen, that might be, but still, that you still get the, it's like a shock. It's a shock to the soil. Yeah, he says he doesn't age chips. It depends. If it's a hardwood, aged 1 year is not going to do a whole lot, right? If it's a pine, it might be semi-broken down, but why not just do a compost? Because of the pH, yeah.
I'm going to go to a cow compost right now. Sorry, I couldn't see, but the nematode supposed to slow down, like sort of paralysis when you heat under it, when you put a fire under it, rather. Sorry, we couldn't find it after I put it back, but we're going to go to a cow compost and see if we can find some nematodes there. I will say that all of the nematodes that I've ever found in my worm compost have all been bacterial feeding. So that's probably what was there.
I have a quick question about the studies of the protozoa bacteria ratios. Have they incorporated free organic matter into that study? The reason I ask is because the amount of available organic matter is going to make a difference on that ratio. That's accurate, right? So have they put that into another axis to figure out another variable, if you will? Does that make sense, the question I'm asking?
So I don't see how the free organic matter relates to the biomass of ratio between the fungi and the bacteria, though. So could you explain that?
Not really, because I'm asking if they've taken that into account, the amount of free organic matter.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
The free amount of free organic matter should influence that ratio. Is that accurate?
Free organic. How so? How so?
I don't know.
Oh. Yeah, I guess I'm unclear about. I guess I'm unclear about what free organic matter is. Yeah. Huh. I don't know. I don't know if they took that into account. I'm sorry. Okay, so this is at 5, and I don't see any nematodes, but this is now at 40 times magnification. Actually, it's 400 times magnification because the eyepiece is at like 100. So anyways, this is where we're looking for that could be like a fungal... That's a spore right there. You see that in the center? So we see nice round and dark circles, and that's indication of a fungal spore. These are just minerals, you know, mineral rocks. We ignore that. This is like a fulvic acid, so that's decomposing. That's just a air bubble, indication of a bad preparation. But I don't see any, amoebae, like we saw tested amoebae in the worm compost, but this should have some fungi. And I did see a really slow nematode the other day in this compost, like a nematode moving so slow, I didn't realize. What is this? So this is some filamentous microorganism. I don't see a, it's sort of out of, it's on different planes, and that's why it looks awkward, but I don't see a septa here, so I would say that this is not this is likely not a beneficial microorganism. This might be it is even, I think I'd have to do more. More investigation. This might be, an oomycete. So this right there may be a beginning of a mycelium. We can see that the ends are very like 90 degrees, and there's this wall right here. There's discolored a bit. So, not discolored, but it has a different color than the background. So this could be the beginning of a mycelium forming. So we don't see really the flagellates. This could be the actinobacteria that we were talking about earlier. Has very hair-like, thin filamentous body. Okay, then let me prepare the mushroom slide, which I have not seen before. So I am very interested. Does anyone else have any questions?
Questions? Did you want? Got twice? Not sold? Okay. You have a question?
So I'm not sure if this has already been asked, but what sort of resources would you recommend for learning what you're looking at under the microscope? Like, is it YouTube videos, books, anything like that to get a sense of what's what?
So there's an awesome book. It's Teeming with Microbes. Is it E or A? I don't know. Teeming. Teeming with Microbes, and this like Lowenfels, I think, is the author. Dr. Ingham has plenty of lectures on YouTube, Ingham. And those are two principal things.
Are there any beneficial oomycetes that you know of?
There. No.
I don't think there are. They're, you know, that's kind of like the.
Yeah.
They're waterborne and they're moving around fast to get to that plant.
No, yeah, I would say I haven't heard any beneficial oomycetes stories.
But there are so many things we haven't identified.
Correct.
Yet. You know, soil is challenging. I mean, the nematodes, I did my research in nematodes on cherry ring spot. It's a vector. Ziphanem is a vector of it. And there are more nematode species than there are insects. And my first class of nematology a million years ago, the professor said, if we took all the species of nematodes and put them on the walls, there wouldn't be enough walls in this classroom. And we saw how small these guys are. So we haven't figured out, we don't have, you know, how to identify them properly. And even, are they good guys or bad guys? Well, in this case, they're a good guy. And we hope that that's always the case, but you never know. And then we get excited about things like ring-trapping fungi that we saw, I call them the cowboys. People say, oh, I'm going to get some of them and put them in my soil. Well, look how fast they move. You have 10 acres of vegetables. How are they going to get from one end to the other? So that's the challenge with, you know, inoculation of your field with these little guys. It's like they don't move very fast. And tillage helps them move. We've seen that in the bad guys. You know, you'll see rings of infections in your field as you till, in the direction of you till, as the disease progresses. But, you know, you have to take it all with a grain of salt, and you just want to keep improving that soil health so that not only is your soil able to defend itself with these good guy bacteria and fungi, but you also need to consider making that crop as resilient and strong as possible. To sustain drought, excess rains, a little bit of disease. Yeah. So it's a whole library of action that a good farmer needs to take. Are there other questions, comments, something you'd like to share? A lot of you know stuff that could benefit all of us. Okay. Okay.
My name is Mike Erdman. I'm from Illinois. I'm in the soil health business, and we're doing a lot of research with studying microbiology. We're doing PLFA tests through region labs and ward labs in Nebraska, measuring fungi to bacteria counts, also protozoa. One of the things we're finding is some research coming out of Cornell University on poxycarbon, or they call it labile carbon, or active carbon. Basically, it's an carbon molecule that's very active in soil because it's loaded with oxygen. And we're finding out the bacteria and fungi, particularly the fungi, love this for their food. So when we propagate these soils with more active carbon, which is part of your humus fraction, we get big developments of more biology growing. And this is part of Lane Ingram's research. She's doing this compost, so she's creating more humic and fulvic acids. That's part of the active carbon chains. And there's 13 of them all together. And each of them affect different enzymes in the soil. And you got a new researcher, Dr. Mike Lehman, out at South Dakota, with South Dakota State, along with USDA, is researching a C13 chart and finding out which active carbon chains are most responsive of feeding the mycorrhizal fungi. So there's a lot of research going on. Oh, by the way, there is a carbon on the market called humates they're bringing to the market, which is an active carbon. It's the top layer of a coal mine. They call it libilc or lignite ore. And so you can buy that in the market to supplement your soils.
And if you do have your soils tested, and epoxy is an option, it's a great visual. It is by coloration, you can see the amount of nitrogen in your soil so that you're able to understand it a little easier. I did a poster here a couple years ago. We were working on it in intermediate wheatgrass for Michigan State University. And so it's not costly. And it's quick. You know, it's not like you have to do an incubation forever or anything. And it's very visual, so it really tells a story in its impact, its effect. Yes, P-O-X-Y. Oh, Y-C? Oh, you've added the C onto it now. Oh, okay. It's evolving because, it was kind of novel 6-7 years ago, and so they put a C onto it for carbon. Carbon, yeah, C is carbon. And so they've thrown a C on, but if you put PXY, it'll come up.
So I just want to point out, I'm not seeing a lot of protozoa in here, but of course we can see all these bacteria sort of moving around. And, this is the usual thing. You know, you're not going to do, bacteria is not going anywhere. So you're going to see them in every sample, but we want to see those fungi, those protozoa, in the sample. I did see a fungal spore, and in our counts that we do, we don't count spores and eggs. We only count the live things that we see, because the idea is that we don't know, like, under what conditions it's going to sort of sporulate, or not sporulate, but sort of become, develop. In some samples, we don't see any evidence of the fungal spores, right? But the idea would be, we'd like to see more fungi and protozoa in here. And this is mushroom. Well, this is a mushroom compost, so this is the first time I'm looking at it.
Were they organic mushrooms?
Yes, it was organic mushroom compost. Sure. And also, sort of separate from the soil food web, mechanism, is the rhizophagy mechanism. Has everyone heard about rhizophagy? So in terms of the things that we don't know, or that we're just learning about plants and bacteria relationship, we're seeing that plants actually uptake bacteria. Like, they go into the plant strips off the outer membrane of the bacteria, sends it out through a root hair, like alive. And so I don't know, there's so much we don't know, but they just found that this mechanism is literally happening in a lot of different plants. And I don't know why the bacteria decides that this is a good thing to do, but getting stripped of its outer coating, and the plant absorbs that, material. But it's a brave new world down there. So that's just something we're only realizing that we didn't know. Anyway, 10:16. Thank you, everyone. Oh, do you have another?